Chapter 23, The Testing. Nynaeve warily eyed the huge chamber far beneath the White Tower and eyed Shiriam at her side just as warily. The mistress of novices seemed expectant, perhaps even a little impatient. In her few days in Tar Valon, Nynaeve had seen only serenity in the Aes Sedai and a smiling acceptance of events coming in their own time. The domed room had been carved out of the bedrock of the island, the light of lamps on tall stands reflected from pale, smooth stone walls. Centered under the dome was a thing made of three rounded silver arches, each just tall enough to walk under, sitting on a thick silver ring with their ends touching each other. Arches and ring were all of one piece. She could not see what lay inside. There the light flickered oddly, and made her stomach flutter with it if she looked too long. Where arch touched ring, an Aes Sedai sat cross-legged on the bare stone of the floor, staring at the silvery construction. Another stood nearby, beside a plain table on which sat three large silver chalices. Each, Nynaeve knew, or at least she had been told, was filled with clear water. All four Aes Sedai wore their shawls, as Shiriam did. Blue-fringed for Shiriam, red for the swarthy woman by the table, green, white, and gray for the three around the arches. Nynaeve still wore one of the dresses she had been given in Faldara, pale green embroidered with small white flowers. "First you leave me to stare at my thumbs from morning to night," Nynaeve muttered, "and now it's all in a rush." "The hour waits on no woman," Shiriam replied. "The wheel weaves as the wheel wills, and when it wills. Patience is a virtue that must be learned, but we must all be ready for the change of an instant." Nynaeve tried not to glare. The most irritating thing she had yet discovered about the flame-haired Aes Sedai was that she sometimes sounded as if she were quoting sayings even when she was not. "What is that thing?"
"A Tir Angrial."
"Well, that tells me nothing. What does it do?"
"Tir Angrial do many things, child. Like Angrial and Sa'angrial, they are remnants of the Age of Legends that use the one power, though they are not quite so rare as the other two. While some Tir Angrial must be made to work by Aes Sedai, as this one must, others will do what they do simply with the presence of any woman who can channel. There are even supposed to be some that will function for anyone at all. Unlike Angrial and Sa'angrial, they were made to do specific things. One other we have in the tower makes oaths binding. When you are raised to full sisterhood, you will take your final vows, holding that Tir Angrial, to speak no word that is not true, to make no weapon for one man to kill another, never to use the one power as a weapon except against dark friends or shadow spawn, or in the last extreme of defending your own life, that of your warder, or that of another sister. Nynaeve shook her head. It sounded either like too much to swear or too little, and she said so.
"Once Aes Sedai were not required to swear oaths. It was known what Aes Sedai were and what they stood for, and there was no need for more. Many of us wish it were so still. But the wheel turns and the times change. That we swear these oaths, that we are known to be bound, allows the nations to deal with us without fearing that we will throw up our own power, the one power, against them. Between the Trolloc Wars and the War of the Hundred Years, we made these choices, and because of them, the White Tower still stands, and we can still do what we can against the Shadow." Shiriam drew a deep breath. "Light, child, I am trying to teach you what any other woman standing where you are would have learned over the course of years. It cannot be done. Tir Angrial are what must concern you now. We don't know why they were made. We dare use only a handful of them, and the ways in which we do dare to use them may be nothing like the purposes the makers intended. Most we have learned to our cost to avoid. Over the years, no few Aes Sedai have been killed, or had their talent burned out of them, learning that." Nynaeve shivered.
"And you want me to walk into this one?"
The light inside the arches flickered less now, but she could see what lay in it no better. "We know what this one does. It will bring you face to face with your greatest fears." Shiriam smiled pleasantly. "No one will ask you what you have faced. You need tell no more than you wish. Every woman's fears are her own property." Vaguely, Nynaeve thought about her nervousness concerning spiders, especially in the dark,
but she did not think that was what Shiryam meant. "I just walk through one arch and out another? 3 times through and it's done?" The Aes Sedai adjusted her shawl with an irritated hitch of her shoulder. "If you wish to boil it down that far, yes," she said dryly. "I told you on the way here what you must know about the ceremony as much as anyone is allowed to know beforehand. If you were a novice come to this, you would know it by heart. But don't worry about making mistakes. I will remind you if necessary. Are you sure you are ready to face it? If you want to stop now, I can still write your name in the novice book." "No." "Very well, then. 2 things I will tell you now that no woman hears until she is in this room. The first is this. Once you begin, you must continue to the end. Refuse to go on, and no matter your potential, you will be very kindly put out of the tower with enough silver to support you for a year, and you will never be allowed back." Nynaeve opened her mouth to say she would not refuse, but Shiryam cut her off with a sharp gesture. "Listen, and speak when you know what to say. 2nd, to seek, to strive, is to know danger. You will know danger here. Some women have entered and never come out. When the Turangrial was allowed to grow quiet, they were not there, and they were never seen again. If you will survive, you must be steadfast. Falter, fail, and—" Her silence was more eloquent than any words. "This is your last chance, child. You may turn back now, right now, and I will put your name in the novice book, and you will have only 1 mark against you. 2x more you will be allowed to come here, and only at the 3rd refusal will you be put out of the tower. It is no shame to refuse. Many do. I myself could not do it my 1st time here. Now you may speak." Nynaeve gave the silver arches a sidelong look. The light in them no longer flickered. They were filled with a soft white glow. To learn what she wanted to learn, she needed the freedom of the accepted to question, to study on her own, with no more guidance than she asked for. "I must make Moiraine pay for what she has done to us. I must." "I am ready." Shiryam started slowly into the chamber. Nynaeve went beside her. As if that were a signal, the Red Sister spoke in loud, formal tones. "Whom do you bring with you, sister?" The 3 Aes Sedai around the Turangrial continued their attentions to it. "One who comes as a candidate for acceptance, sister," Shiryam replied just as formally. "Is she ready?" "She is ready to leave behind what she was, and passing through her fears, gain acceptance." "Does she know her fears?" "She has never faced them, but now is willing." "Then let her face what she fears." Shiryam stopped, 2 spans from the arches, and Nynaeve stopped with her. "Your dress," Shiryam whispered, not looking at her. Nynaeve's cheeks colored at forgetting already what Shiryam had told her on the way down from her room. Hastily, she removed her clothes, her shoes, and stockings. For a moment, she could almost forget the arches in folding her garments and putting them neatly to one side. She tucked Lan's ring carefully under her dress. She did not want anyone staring at that. Then she was done, and the Turangrial was still there, still waiting. The stone felt cold under her bare feet, and she broke out all over in goosebumps, but she stood straight and breathed slowly. She would not let any of them see she was afraid. "The 1st time, Shiryam said, "is for what was. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast." Nynaeve hesitated. Then she stepped forward, through the arch and into the glow. It surrounded her as if the air itself were shining, as if she were drowning in light. The light was everywhere. The light was everything. Nynaeve gave a start when she realized she was naked, then stared in amazement. A stone wall stood to either side of her, 2x as tall as she was and smooth, as if carved. Her toes wriggled on dusty, uneven stone paving. The sky above seemed flat and leaden, for all the lack of clouds, and the sun hung overhead, swollen and red. In both directions were openings in the wall, gateways marked by short, square columns. The walls narrowed her field of view, but the ground sloped down from where she stood, both in front and behind. Through the gateways she could see more thick walls and passages between. She was in a gigantic maze. Where is this? How did I come here? Like a different voice, another thought came. The way out will come but once. She shook her head. If there's only one way out, I'll not find it standing here. At least the air was warm and dry. I hope I find some clothes before I find people, she muttered. Dimly, she remembered playing mazes on paper as a child. There had been a trick to finding your way out, but she could not bring it to mind. Everything in the past seemed vague, as if it had happened to someone else. Trailing a hand along the wall, she started out, dust rising in puffs beneath her bare feet. At the first opening in the wall, she found herself peering down another passage that seemed indistinguishable from the one she was in already. Taking a deep breath, she went on straight, through more passages that all looked exactly alike. Presently, she came to something different. The way forked. She took the left turning, and eventually it forked again. Once more, she went left. At the third fork, left brought her to a blank wall. Grimly, she walked back to the last fork and went right. This time, it took four turnings right to bring her to a dead end. For a moment, she stood glaring at it. "How did I get here?" she demanded loudly. "Where is this place?" "The way out will come but once." Once more, she turned back. She was sure there had to be a trick to the maze. At the last fork, she went left, then right at the next. Determined, she kept on. Left, then right. Straight until she came to a fork. Left, then right. It seemed to her to be working. At least she had gone past a dozen forkings this time without finding an end. She came to another. Out of the corner of her eye, she caught a flicker of motion. When she turned to look, there was only the dusty passage between smooth stone walls. She started to take the left fork and spun around at another glimpse of movement. There was nothing there, but this time she was sure. There had been someone behind her. Was someone. She broke into a nervous trot in the opposite direction. Again and again, now, just at the edge of vision down this side passage or that, she saw something move, too quick to make out, gone before she could turn her head to see it plainly. She broke into a run. Few boys had been able to outrun her when she was a girl in the Two Rivers. The Two Rivers? What is that? A man stepped out from an opening ahead of her. His dark clothes had a musty, half-rotted look, and he was old. Older than old. Skin like crazed parchment covered his skull too tightly, as if there were no flesh beneath. Wispy tufts of brittle hair covered a scabbed scalp, and his eyes were so sunken they seemed to peer out of two caves. She skidded to a stop, the uneven paving stones rough under her feet.
"I am Aginor," he said, smiling, "and I have come for you."
Her heart tried to leap out of her chest. One of the Forsaken. No. No, it cannot be.
"You are a pretty one, girl. I will enjoy you."
Suddenly, Nynaeve remembered she wore not a stitch. With a yelp and a face red only partly from anger, she darted away down the nearest crossing passage. Cackling laughter pursued her, and the sound of a shuffling run that seemed to match her best speed, and breathy promises of what he would do when he caught her, promises that curdled her stomach, even only half heard. Desperately, she searched for a way out, peering frantically as she ran with fists clenched. "The way out will come but once. Be steadfast." There was nothing, only more of the endless maze. As hard as she could run, his filthy words came always right behind her. Slowly, fear turned completely to anger. "Burn him," she sobbed. "The light, burn him. He has no right." Within her, she felt a flowering, an opening up, an unfolding to light. Teeth bared, she turned to face her pursuer just as Aginor appeared, laughing in a lurching gallop. "You have no right!" She flung her fist toward him, fingers opening as if she were throwing something. She was only half surprised to see a ball of fire leave her hand. It exploded against Aginor's chest, knocking him to the ground. For only an instant he sprawled there, then rose, staggering. He seemed unaware of the smoldering front of his coat.
"You dare! You dare!"
He quivered, and spittle leaked down his chin. Abruptly, there were clouds in the sky, threatening billows of gray and black. Lightning leaped from the clouds straight for Nynaeve's heart. It seemed to her, just for a heartbeat, as if time had suddenly slowed, as though that heartbeat took forever. She felt the flow inside her. Saidar, came a distant thought, felt the answering flow in the lightning, and she altered the direction of the flow. Time leaped forward. With a crash, the bolt shattered stone above Aginor's head. The Forsaken's sunken eyes widened, and he tottered back.
You cannot! It cannot be!
He leaped away as lightning struck where he had stood, stone erupting in a fountain of shards. Grimly, Nynaeve started toward him, and Aginor fled. Saidar was a torrent racing through her. She could feel the rocks around her and the air, feel the tiny flowing bits of the one power that suffused them and made them. And she could feel Aginor doing something as well. Dimly she felt it, and far distant, as if it were something she could never truly know, but around her she saw the effects and knew them for what they were. The ground rumbled and heaved under her feet. Walls toppled in front of her, piles of stone to block her way. She scrambled over them, uncaring if sharp rock cut hands and feet, always keeping Aginor in sight. A wind rose, howling down the passages against her, raging till it flattened her cheeks and made her eyes water, trying to knock her down. She changed the flow, and Aginor tumbled along the passageway like an uprooted bush. She touched the flow in the ground, redirected it, and stone walls collapsed around Aginor, sealing him in. Lightning fell with her glare striking around him, stone exploding ever closer and closer. She could feel him fighting to push it back at her, but foot by foot the dazzling bolts moved toward the Forsaken. Something gleamed off to her right, something uncovered by the collapsing walls. Nynaeve could feel Aginor weakening, feel his efforts to strike at her grow more feeble and more frantic. Yet somehow she knew he had not given up. If she let him go now, he would chase after her as strongly as before, convinced she was too weak to defeat him after all, too weak to stop him from doing with her as he wished. A silver arch stood where stone had been, an arch filled with soft silver radiance. The way back. She knew when the Forsaken abandoned his attack, the moment when all his efforts were given over to staving her off, and his power was not enough. He could no longer deflect her blows. Now he had to fling himself away from the leaping gouts of stone thrown up by her lightning, the explosions flinging him down again. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. The lightning no longer fell. Nynaeve turned from the scrabbling Aginor to look at the arch. She looked back at Aginor, just in time to see him crawl out of sight over the mounded stone and disappear. She hissed in frustration. Much of the maze still stood, and 100 new places to hide in the rubble she and the Forsaken had made. It would take time to find him again, but she was sure if she did not find him first, he would find her. In his full strength, he would come on her when she least expected him. The way back will come but once. Frightened, she looked again and was relieved to see the arch still there. If she could find Aginor quickly, be steadfast. With a cry of thwarted anger, she climbed over the tumbled stone toward the arch. Whoever's responsible for me being here, she muttered. I'll make them wish they had gotten what Aginor got. She stepped into the arch, and the light overwhelmed her. Nynaeve stepped out of the arch and stopped to stare. It was all as she remembered, the silver Tarangrial, the Aes Sedai, the chamber, but remembering was like a blow, absent memories crashing back into her head. She had come out of the same arch by which she went in. The Red Sister raised one of the silver chalices high and poured a stream of cool, clear water over Nynaeve's head.
You are washed clean of what sin you may have done, the Aes Sedai intoned, and of those done against you. You are washed clean of what crime you may have committed, and of those committed against you. You come to us washed clean and pure, in heart and soul.
Nynaeve shivered as the water ran down her body,
dripping on the floor. Shiriam took her arm with a relieved smile, but the mistress of novices' voice gave no hint of past worry.
You do well so far. Coming back is doing well. Remember what your purpose is, and you will continue to be well.
The redhead began to lead her around the Terangrial to another arch.
It was so real, Nynaeve said in a whisper. She could remember everything, remember channeling the one power as easily as lifting her hand. She could remember Aginor and the things the Forsaken wanted to do to her. She shivered again.
Was it real?
No one knows, Shiriam replied. It seems real in memory, and some have come out bearing the actual wounds of hurts taken inside. Others have been cut to the bone inside and come back without a mark. It is all of it different every time for every woman who goes in. The ancients said there were many worlds. Perhaps this Terangrial takes you to them. Yet, if so, it does so under very stringent rules for something meant just to take you from one place to another. I believe it is not real. But remember, whether what happens is real or not, the danger is as real as a knife plunging into your heart.
I channeled the power.
It was so easy.
Shiriam missed a step.
That isn't supposed to be possible. You should not even remember being able to channel.
She studied Nynaeve.
And yet you are not harmed. I can still sense the ability in you, as strong as it ever was.
You sound as if it were dangerous, Nynaeve said slowly,
and Shiriam hesitated before answering.
It isn't thought necessary to give a warning, since you shouldn't be able to remember it, but
this Terangrial was found during the Trolloc Wars. We have the records of its examination in the archives. The first sister to enter was warded as strongly as she could be, since no one knew what it would do. She kept her memories, and she channeled the one power when she was threatened, and she came out with her abilities burned to nothing, unable to channel, unable even to sense the true source. The second to go in was also warded, and she too was destroyed in the same way. The third went unprotected, remembered nothing once she was inside, and returned unharmed. That is one reason why we send you completely unprotected.
Nynaeve, you must not channel inside the Terangrial again. I know it is hard to remember anything, but try.
Nynaeve swallowed. She could remember everything, could remember not remembering.
I won't channel, she said.
If I can remember not to. She wanted to laugh hysterically.
They had reached the next arch. The glow still filled them all. Shiriam gave Nynaeve a last warning look and left her standing alone.
The second time is for what is. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast.
Nynaeve stared at the shining silver arch.
What is in there this time?
The others were waiting, watching. She stepped firmly through into the light. Nynaeve stared down at the plain brown dress she wore with surprise, then gave a start. Why was she staring at her own dress?
The way back will come but once.
Looking around her, she smiled. She stood on the edge of the green in Emmons Field, with thatch-roofed houses all around and the Winespring Inn right in front of her. The Winespring itself rose in a gush from the stone outcrop thrusting up through the grass of the green, and the Winespring water rushed off east under the willows beside the inn. The streets were empty, but most people would be at their chores this time of the morning. Looking at the inn, her smile faded. There was more than an air of neglect about it. A whitewash faded, a shutter hanging loose, the rotted end of a rafter showing at a gap in the roof tiles.
What's gotten into Bran? Is he spending so much time being mayor he's forgetting to take care of his inn?
The inn door swung open, and Senbui came out, stopping dead when he saw her. The old thatcher was as gnarled as an oak root, and the look he gave her was just as friendly.
So you've come back, have you? Well, you might as well be off again.
She frowned as he spat at her feet and hurried on past her. Sen was never a pleasant man, but he was seldom openly rude. Never to her, at least. Never to her face. Following him with her eye, she saw signs of neglect all through the village. Thatch that should have been mended. Weeds filling yards. The door on Mistress Alcar's house hung aslant on a broken hinge. Shaking her head, Nynaeve pushed into the inn.
I'll have more than one word with Bran about this. The common room was empty except for a lone woman, her thick graying braid pulled over her shoulder. She was wiping a table, but from the way she stared at the tabletop, Nynaeve did not think she was aware of what she was doing. The room seemed dusty.
Marin?
Marin Alvear jumped, one hand clutching her throat, and stared. She looked years older than Nynaeve remembered, worn.
Nynaeve? Nynaeve! Oh, it is you. Egwene? Have you brought Egwene back? Say you have.
Nynaeve put a hand to her head. Where is Egwene? It seemed she should be able to remember.
No.
No, I haven't brought her back. The way back will come but once. Mistress Alvear sagged into one of the straight-backed chairs.
I was so hoping, ever since Bran died. Bran is dead?
Nynaeve could not imagine it. That broad, smiling man had always seemed as if he would go on forever.
I should have been here.
The other woman jumped to her feet and hurried to peer anxiously through a window at the green and the village.
If Malaena knows you're here, there will be trouble. I just know Sen went scurrying off to find her. He's the mayor now.
Sen? How did even those wool-headed men choose Sen?
It was Malaena. She had the whole women's circle after their husbands for him.
Marin pressed her face almost against the window, trying to look every way at once.
Silly men, don't talk about whose name they're putting in the box beforehand. I suppose every man who voted for Sen thought he was the only one whose wife had badged him into it. Thought one vote would make no difference. Well, they learned better. We all did.
Who is this Malaena who has the women's circle doing her bidding? I've never heard of her.
She's from Watch Hill. She's the wiz... Marin turned from the window, wringing her hands.
Malaena Aelar's the wisdom, Nynaeve. When you didn't come back. Light, I hope she doesn't find out you're here.
Nynaeve shook her head in wonder.
Marin, you're afraid of her. You are shaking. What kind of woman is she? Why did the women's circle ever choose someone like her?
Mistress Alvear gave a bitter laugh.
We must have been mad. Malaena came down to see Mavra Mallon the day before Mavra had to go back to Devon Ride, and that night some children took sick, and Malaena stayed to look after them, and then the sheep started dying, and Malaena took care of that, too. It just seemed natural to choose her, but...
She's a bully, Nynaeve. She browbeats you into doing what she wants. She keeps at you until you're too tired to say no anymore, and worse, she knocked Alspeth Luhan down.
A picture flashed in Nynaeve's head of Alspeth Luhan and her husband, Harald the blacksmith. She was nearly as tall as him and stoutly built, though handsome.
Alspeth's almost as strong as Harald. I can't believe. Malaena's not a big woman, but she's fierce, Nynaeve. She beat Alspeth all around the green with a stick, and none of us who saw had the nerve to try to stop it. When they found out, Bran and Harald said she had to go, even if they were interfering in women's circle business. I think some of the circle might have listened, but Bran and Harald both took sick the same night and died within a day of each other.
Marin bit her lip and looked around the room as if she thought someone might be hiding there. Her voice lowered.
Malaena mixed medicine for them. She said it was her duty, even if they had spoken against her. I saw gray fennel in what she took away with her.
Nynaeve gasped.
But are you sure, Marin? Are you certain?
The other woman nodded, her face wrinkling on the point of tears.
Marin, if you even suspected this woman might have poisoned Bran, how could you not go to the circle? She said Bran and Harald didn't walk in the light, Marin mumbled, talking against the wisdom the way they did. She said that was why they died. The light abandoned them. She talks about Sin all the time. She said Pete Alcar Sin talking against her after Bran and Harald died. All he said was she didn't have the way with healing you did, but she drew the dragon's fang on his door, right out where everyone could see her with the charcoal in her hand. Both his boys were dead before the week was out, just dead when their mother went to wake them. Poor Neela. We found her wandering, laughing and crying all at the same time, screaming that Pete was the Dark One and he'd killed her boys. Pete hung himself the next day.
She shuddered and her voice went so soft Nynaeve could barely hear it.
I have four daughters still living under my roof.
Living, Nynaeve. Do you understand what I'm saying? They're still alive, and I want to keep them alive.
Nynaeve felt cold to her bones.
Maren, you can't allow this.
The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. She pushed it away.
If the women's circle stands together, you can be rid of her.
Stand together against Malaena? Maren's laugh was nearer a sob.
We're all afraid of her, but she's good with the children. There are always children sick these days, it seems, but Malaena does the best she can. Almost no one ever died of sickness when you were wisdom.
Maren, listen to me.
Don't you see why there are always children sick? If she can't make you afraid of her, she makes you think you need her for the children. She's doing it, Maren, just as she did it to Bran.
She couldn't, Maren breathed.
She wouldn't. Not the little ones.
She is, Maren. The way back. Nynaeve suppressed the thought ruthlessly.
Is there anyone in the circle who isn't afraid? Anyone who will listen?
The other woman said,
no one who isn't afraid. But Corin Ayelin might listen. If she does, she might bring two or three more. Nynaeve, if enough of the circle listens, will you be our wisdom again? I think you may be the only one who won't back down to Malaena, even if we all know. You don't know what she's like.
I will. The way back.
No, these are my people. Get your cloak and we'll go to Corin.
Maren was hesitant about leaving the inn, and once Nynaeve had her outside, she slunk along from doorstep to doorstep, crouching and watching. Before they were halfway to Corin Ayelin's house, Nynaeve saw a tall, scrawny woman striding down the other side of the green toward the inn, slashing the heads off weeds with a thick willow switch. Bony as she was, she had a look of wiry strength and a set, determined slash of a mouth. Sen Bui scuttled along in her wake.
Malaena?
Maren pulled Nynaeve into the space between two houses and whispered as if afraid the woman might hear across the green.
I knew Sen would go to her.
Something made Nynaeve look over her shoulder. Behind her stood a silver arch, reaching from house to house, glowing whitely.
The way back will come but once. Be steadfast.
Maren gave a soft scream.
She's seen us. Light, help us, she's coming this way.
The tall woman had turned across the green, leaving Sen standing uncertainly. There was no uncertainty on Malaena's face. She walked slowly, as if there were no hope of escape, a cruel smile growing with every step. Maren tugged at Nynaeve's sleeve.
We have to run. We have to hide. Nynaeve, come on. Sen will have told her who you are. She hates anyone even to speak of you.
The silver arch pulled Nynaeve's eyes.
The way back.
She shook her head, trying to remember. It is not real. She looked at Maren. Stark terror twisted the woman's face. You must be steadfast to survive.
Please, Nynaeve. She's seen me with you. She has seen me. Please, Nynaeve.
Malaena came closer, implacable.
My people.
The arch shone. The way back. It is not real. With a sob, Nynaeve tore her arm out of Maren's grasp and plunged toward the silvery glow. Maren's shriek hounded her.
For the love of the light, Nynaeve, help me! Help me!
The glow enveloped her. Staring, Nynaeve staggered out of the arch, barely aware of the chamber or the Aes Sedai. Maren's last cry still rang in her ears. She did not flinch when cold water was suddenly poured over her head.
You are washed clean of false pride. You are washed clean of false ambition. You come to us washed clean in heart and soul.
As the red Aes Sedai stepped back, Shiriam came to take Nynaeve's arm. Nynaeve gave a start, then realized who it was. She seized the collar of Shiriam's dress in both hands.
Tell me it was not real. Tell me.
Bad? Shiriam pried her hands loose as if she were used to this reaction.
It is always worse, and the third is the worst of all. I left my friend. I left my people in the pit of doom to come back. Please, Light, it was not real. I didn't really. I have to make Moiraine pay. I have to.
There is always some reason not to return, something to prevent you or distract you. This Terangreal weaves traps for you from your own mind, weaves them tight and strong, harder than steel and more deadly than poison. That is why we use it as a test. You must want to be Aes Sedai more than anything else in the whole world, enough to face anything, fight free of anything to achieve it. The White Tower cannot accept less. We demand it of you.
You demand a great deal.
Nynaeve stared at the third arch as the red-haired Aes Sedai took her toward it. The third is the worst.
I'm afraid, she whispered.
What could be worse than what I just did?
Good, Shiriam said. You seek to be Aes Sedai, to channel the One Power. No one should approach that without fear and awe. Fear will keep you cautious. Caution will keep you alive.
She turned Nynaeve to face the arch, but she did not step back immediately.
No one will force you to enter a third time, child.
Nynaeve licked her lips.
If I refuse, you'll put me out of the tower and never let me come back.
Shiriam nodded.
And this is the worst. Shiriam nodded again.
Nynaeve drew breath.
I'm ready.
The third time, Shiriam intoned formally, is for what will be. The way back will come but once. Be steadfast. Nynaeve threw herself at the arch in a run. Laughing, she ran through swirling clouds of butterflies rising from wildflowers that covered the hilltop meadow with a knee-deep blanket of color. Her gray mare danced nervously, reins dangling at the edge of the meadow, and Nynaeve stopped running so as not to frighten the animal more. Some of the butterflies settled on her dress, on flowers of embroidery and seed pearls, or flittered around the sapphires and moonstones in her hair, hanging loose about her shoulders. Below the hill, the necklace of the Thousand Lakes spread through the city of Malkyr, reflecting the cloud-brushing seven towers, with golden crane banners flying at their heights in the mists. The city had a thousand gardens, but she preferred this wild garden on the hilltop.
The way back will come but once. Be steadfast.
The sound of hooves made her turn.
Al-Lan Mandragoran, king of Malkyr, leaped from the back of his charger and strolled toward her through the butterflies, laughing. His face had the look of a hard man, but the smiles he wore for her softened the stony plains. She gaped at him, taken by surprise when he gathered her into his arms and kissed her. For a moment she clung to him, lost, kissing him back. Her feet dangled a foot in the air and she did not care. Suddenly she pushed at him, pulled her face back.
No, she pushed harder. Let me go. Put me down.
Puzzled, he lowered her until her feet touched ground. She backed away from him.
Not this, she said. I cannot face this. Anything but this.
Please let me face Aginor again.
Memory swirled.
Aginor? She did not know where that thought had come from.
Memory lurched and tilted, shifting fragments like broken ice on a flooding river. She clawed for the pieces, clawed for something to hang on to.
Are you well, my love?
Lan asked worriedly.
Do not call me that. I am not your love. I cannot marry you.
He startled her by throwing back his head and roaring with laughter.
Your implication that we are not married might upset our children, wife. And how are you not my love?
I have no other and will have no other.
I must go back.
Desperately, she looked for the arch, found only meadow and sky.
Harder than steel and more deadly than poison. Lan, Lan's babies, light, help me. I must go back now.
Go back? Where? To Emmons Field? If you wish it, I'll send letters to Morgaze and command an escort.
Alone, she muttered, still searching. Where is it? I have to go.
I won't be tangled up in this. I couldn't bear it. Not this. I have to go now.
Tangled up in what, Nynaeve? What is it you couldn't bear? No, Nynaeve. You can ride alone here if you wish it, but if the Queen of the Malkyri came to Andor without a proper escort, Morgaze would be scandalized if not offended. You don't want to offend her, do you? I thought you two were friends.
Nynaeve felt as if she'd been hit in the head, blow after dazing blow.
Queen, she said hesitantly, we have babies?
Are you certain you're well?
I think I had better take you to Sharina Sedai.
No.
She backed away from him again.
No, Aes Sedai.
It isn't real. I won't be pulled into it this time. I won't.
Very well, he said slowly.
As my wife, how could you not be queen? We are Malkyrie here, not Southlanders. You were crowned in the Seven Towers at the same time we exchanged rings. Unconsciously, he moved his left hand. A plain gold band encircled his forefinger. She glanced at her own hand, at the ring she knew would be there. She clasped her other hand over it, but whether to deny its presence by hiding it or to hold it, she could not have said.
Do you remember now? He went on.
He stretched out a hand as if to brush her cheek, and she went back another 6 steps. He sighed.
As you wish, my love.
We have 3 children, though only one can properly be called a baby. Marek is almost to your shoulder and can't decide if he likes horses or books better. Elnor has already begun practicing how to turn boys' heads when she is not pestering Sharina about when she'll be old enough to go to the White Tower.
Elnor was my mother's name, she said softly.
So you said when you chose it.
Nynaeve, no, I will not be pulled into it this time. Not this. I won't.
Beyond him, among the trees beside the meadow, she saw the silver arch. The trees had hidden it before.
The way back will come but once.
She turned toward it.
I must go.
He caught her hand, and it was as if her feet had become rooted in stone. She could not make herself pull away.
I do not know what is troubling you, wife, but whatever it is, tell me and I will make it right. I know I am not the best of husbands. I was all hard edges when I found you, but you've smoothed some of them away at least.
You are the very best of husbands, she murmured.
To her horror, she found herself remembering him as her husband, remembering laughter and tears, bitter arguments and sweet making up. They were dim memories, but she could feel them growing stronger, warmer.
I cannot.
The arch stood there only a few steps away.
The way back will come but once. Be steadfast.
I do not know what is happening, Nynaeve, but I feel as if I were losing you. I could not bear that. He put a hand in her hair. Closing her eyes, she pressed her cheek against his fingers.
Stay with me always.
I want to stay, she said softly. I want to stay with you.
When she opened her eyes, the arch was gone.
Come but once.
No! No!
Lan turned her to face him.
What troubles you?
You must tell me if I'm to help.
This is not real.
Not real?
Before I met you, I thought nothing except the sword was real. Look around you, Nynaeve.
It is real.
Whatever you want to be real, we can make real together, you and I. Wonderingly, she did look around. The meadow was still there. The 7 towers still stood over the 1,000 lakes. The arch was gone, but nothing else had changed.
I could stay here, with Lan. Nothing has changed.
Her thoughts turned. Nothing has changed. Egwene is alone in the White Tower. Rand will channel the power and go mad. And what of Matt and Perrin? Can they take back any shred of their lives? And Moiraine, who tore all our lives apart, still walks free.
I must go back, she whispered.
Unable to bear the pain on his face, she pulled free of him. Deliberately, she formed a flower bud in her mind, a white bud on a blackthorn branch. She made the thorns sharp and cruel, wishing they could pierce her flesh, feeling as if she already hung in the blackthorn's branches. Shiriam Sedai's voice danced just out of hearing, telling her it was dangerous to attempt to channel the power. The bud opened, and Saidar filled her with light.
Nynaeve, tell me what is the matter?
Lan's voice slid across her concentration. She refused to let herself hear it. There had to be a way back still. Staring at where the silver arch had been, she tried to find some trace of it. There was nothing.
Nynaeve!
She tried to picture the arch in her mind, to shape it and form it to the last detail, curve of gleaming metal filled with a glow like snowy fire. It seemed to waver there in front of her, first there between her and the trees, then not, then there.
I love you.
She drew at Sidar, drinking in the flow of the one power till she thought she would burst, the radiance filling her, shining around her, hurt her own eyes. The heat seemed to consume her. The flickering arch firmed, steadied, stood whole before her. Fire and pain seemed to fill her. Her bones felt as if they were burning. Her skull seemed a roaring furnace. "With all my heart." She ran toward the silver curve, not letting herself look back. She had been sure the bitterest thing she would ever hear was Marin Alvear's cry for help as Nynaeve abandoned her, but that was honey beside the sound of Lan's anguished voice pursuing her.
"Nynaeve, please don't leave me."
The white glow consumed her. Naked, Nynaeve staggered through the arch and fell to her knees, slack-mouthed and sobbing, tears streaming down her cheeks. Shiriam knelt beside her. She glared at the red-haired Aes Sedai.
"I hate you," she managed fiercely, gulping. "I hate all Aes Sedai."
Shiriam gave a small sigh, then pulled Nynaeve to her feet. "Child, almost every woman who does this says much the same thing. It is no small thing to be made to face your fears." "What is this?" she said sharply, turning Nynaeve's palms up. Nynaeve's hands quivered with a sudden pain she had not felt before. Driven through the palm of each hand, right in the center, was a long black thorn. Shiriam drew them out carefully. Nynaeve felt the cool healing of the Aes Sedai's touch. When each thorn came free, it left only a small scar on front and back of the hand. Shiriam frowned. "There shouldn't be any scarring. And how did you only get two, and both placed so precisely? If you tangled yourself in a blackthorn bush, you should be covered with scratches and thorns." "I should," Nynaeve agreed bitterly. "Maybe I thought I had already paid enough." "There is always a price," the Aes Sedai agreed. "Come now, you have paid the first price. Take what you have paid for." She gave Nynaeve a slight push forward. Nynaeve realized there were more Aes Sedai in the chamber. The Amyrlin in her striped stole was there, with a shawled sister from each Aja ranged to either side of her, all of them watching Nynaeve. Remembering Shiriam's instruction, Nynaeve tottered forward and knelt before the Amyrlin. It was she who held the last chalice, and she tipped it slowly over Nynaeve's head.
"You are washed clean of Nynaeve Almira from Emmon's Field. You are washed clean of all ties that bind you to the world. You come to us washed clean in heart and soul. You are Nynaeve Almira, accepted of the White Tower."
Handing the chalice to one of the sisters, the Amyrlin drew Nynaeve to her feet.
"You are sealed to us now."
The Amyrlin's eyes seemed to hold a dark glow. Nynaeve's shiver had nothing to do with being naked and wet. Chapter 24. New Friends and Old Enemies. Egwene followed the accepted through the halls of the White Tower. Tapestries and paintings covered walls as white as the outside of the tower. Patterned tiles made the floor. The accepted's white dress was exactly like hers, except for 7 narrow bands of color at hem and cuffs. Egwene frowned looking at that dress. Since yesterday, Nynaeve had worn an accepted's dress, and she seemed to have no joy of it, nor of the golden ring, a serpent eating its own tail, that marked her level. The few times Egwene had been able to see the wisdom, Nynaeve's eyes had seemed shadowed, as if she had seen things she wished with all her heart not to have seen. "In here," the accepted said curtly, gesturing to a door. Named Pedra, she was a short, wiry woman, a little older than Nynaeve, and with a briskness always in her voice. "You're given this time because it is your first day, but I'll expect you in the scullery when the gong sounds high and not one moment later." Egwene curtsied, then stuck out her tongue at the accepted's retreating back. It might have been only the evening before that Shiriam had finally put her name in the novice book, but already she knew she did not like Pedra. She pushed open the door and went in. The room was plain and small with white walls, and there was a young woman with reddish-gold hair spilling around her shoulders, sitting on one of 2 hard benches. The floor was bare. Novices did not get much use of rooms with carpets. Egwene thought the girl was about her own age, but there was a dignity and self-possession about her that made her seem older. The plainly cut novice dress appeared somehow more on her. Elegant, that was it.
"My name is Elaine," she said.
She tilted her head, studying Egwene.
"And you are Egwene, from Emmons Field, in the Two Rivers."
She said it as if it had some significance, but went right on anyway.
"Someone who has been here a little while is always assigned to a new novice for a few days to help her find her way. Sit, please."
Egwene took the other bench, facing Elaine. "I thought the Aes Sedai would teach me now that I'm finally a novice, but all that's happened so far is that Pedro woke me a good 2 hours before first light and put me to sweeping the halls. She says I have to help wash dishes after dinner, too."
Elaine grimaced. "I hate washing dishes. I never had to... Well, that doesn't matter. You will have training. From now on, you will be at training at this hour every day, as a matter of fact. From breakfast until high, then again from dinner to trine. If you are especially quick or especially slow, they may take you from supper to full as well, but that is usually for more chores."
Elaine's blue eyes took on a thoughtful expression.
"You were born with it, weren't you?"
Egwene nodded.
"Yes, I thought I felt it. So was I, born with it. Do not be disappointed if you did not know. You will learn to feel the ability in other women. I had the advantage of growing up around an Aes Sedai."
Egwene wanted to ask about that. Who grows up with Aes Sedai? But Elaine went on.
"And also do not be disappointed if it takes you some time before you can achieve anything. With the one power, I mean. Even the simplest thing takes a little time. Patience is a virtue that must be learned."
Her nose wrinkled.
"Shiriam Sedai always says that, and she does her best to make us all learn it, too. Try to run when she says walk, and she'll have you in her study before you can blink."
"I've had a few lessons already," Egwene said, trying to sound modest. She opened herself to Sayadar, that part of it was easier now, and felt the warmth suffuse her body. She decided to try the biggest thing she knew how to do. She stretched out her hand, and a glowing sphere formed over it, pure light. It wavered. She still could not manage to hold it steady, but it was there. Calmly, Elaine held out her hand, and a ball of light appeared above her palm. Hers flickered, too. After a moment, a faint light glowed all around Elaine. Egwene gasped, and her ball vanished. Elaine giggled suddenly, and her light went out, both the sphere and the light around her.
"You saw it around me?" she said excitedly. "I saw it around you! Shiriam Sedai said I would eventually. This was the first time. For you, too?"
Egwene nodded, laughing along with the other girl.
"I like you, Elaine. I think we're going to be friends." "I think so, too, Egwene. You are from the Two Rivers, from Emmons Field. Do you know a boy named Randall Thor?"
"I know him."
Abruptly, Egwene found herself remembering a tale Rand had told, a tale she had not believed, about falling off a wall into a garden and meeting...
"You're the daughter heir of Andor," she gasped.
"Yes," Elaine said simply. "If Shiriam Sedai as much as heard I'd mentioned it, I think she would have me into her study before I finished talking."
"Everyone talks about being called to Shiriam's study, even the accepted. Does she scold so fiercely? She seems kindly to me."
Elaine hesitated, and when she spoke, it was slowly, not meeting Egwene's eye.
"She keeps a willow switch on her desk. She says if you can't learn to follow the rules in a civilized way, she will teach you another way. There are so many rules for novices. It is very hard not to break some of them," she finished.
"But that's horrible. I'm not a child, and neither are you. I won't be treated as one."
"But we are children. The Aes Sedai, the full sisters, are the grown women. The accepted are the young women, old enough to be trusted without someone looking over their shoulders every moment. And novices are the children, to be protected and cared for, guided in the way they should go, and punished when they do what they should not. That is the way Shiriam Sedai explains it. No one is going to punish you over your lessons, not unless you try something you've been told not to. It is hard not to try sometimes. You will find you want to channel as much as you want to breathe. But if you break too many dishes because you are daydreaming when you should be washing, if you're disrespectful to an accepted,
or leave the tower without permission, or speak to an Aes Sedai before she speaks to you, or... The only thing to do is the best you can. There isn't anything else to do.
It sounds almost as if they're trying to make us want to leave,
Egwene protested.
They aren't, but then again they are. Egwene, there are only 40 novices in the tower. Only 40, and no more than 7 or 8 will become accepted. That is not enough, Shiri Amzadai says. She says there are not enough Aes Sedai now to do what needs to be done. But the tower will not, cannot, lower its standards. The Aes Sedai cannot take a woman as a sister if she does not have the ability and the strength and the desire. They can't give the ring and the shawl to one who cannot channel the power well enough, or who will allow herself to be intimidated, or who will turn back when the road turns rough. Training and testing take care of the channeling, and for strength and desire. Well, if you want to go, they will let you. Once you know enough that you won't die of ignorance.
I suppose, Egwene said slowly.
Shiriam told us some of that. I never thought about there not being enough Aes Sedai, though.
She has a theory. She says we have culled humankind. You know about culling? Cutting out of the herd those animals that have traits you don't like? Egwene nodded impatiently. No one could grow up around sheep without knowing about culling the flock.
Shiri Amzadai says that with the Red Aja hunting down men who could channel for 3,000 years, we are culling the ability to channel out of us all. I would not mention this around any Reds if I were you. Shiri Amzadai has been in more than one shouting match over it, and we are only novices. I won't.
Elaine paused and then said,
Is Rand well?
Egwene felt a sudden stab of jealousy. Elaine was very pretty. But over it came a stronger stab of fear. She went over the little she knew of Rand's one meeting with the daughter heir, reassuring herself. Elaine could not possibly know that Rand could channel.
Egwene? He is as well as he can be.
I hope he is, the wool-headed idiot.
He was riding with some Shinaran soldiers the last I saw him.
Shinarans? He told me he was a shepherd. She shook her head.
I find myself thinking of him at the oddest times. Elida thinks he is important in some way. She didn't come right out and say so, but she ordered a search for him, and she was in a fury when she learned he had left Camelin.
Elida?
Elida Sedai, my mother's counselor. She is Red Aja, but mother seems to like her despite that.
Egwene's mouth felt dry. Red Aja, and interested in Rand.
I don't know where he is now. He left Shinar, and I don't think he was going back.
Elaine gave her a level look.
I would not tell Elida where to find him if I knew Egwene. He has done no wrong that I know, and I fear she wants to use him in some manner. Anyway, I've not seen her since the day we arrived, with white cloaks dogging our trail. They are still camped on the Dragon Mount side.
Abruptly, she bounded to her feet.
Let us talk of happier things. There are 2 others here who know Rand, and I would like you to meet one of them.
She took Egwene's hand and pulled her out of the room.
2 girls? Rand seems to meet a lot of girls.
Still drawing Egwene down the corridor, Elaine studied her.
Yes, well, one of them is a lazy chit named Elsa Grinwell. I don't think she will be here long. She shirks her chores, and she is always sneaking off to watch the warders practice their swords. She says Rand came to her father's farm with a friend of his, Matt. It seems they put notions of the world beyond the next village into her head, and she ran away to come be an Aes Sedai.
Men, Egwene muttered. I dance a few dances with a nice boy, and Rand goes around looking like a dog with a sore tooth, but he... She cut off as a man stepped into the hall ahead of them. Beside her, Elaine stopped, too, and her hand tightened on Egwene's. There was nothing alarming about him, aside from the suddenness of his appearance. He was tall and handsome, short of middle years, with long, dark, curling hair, but his shoulders sagged, and there was sadness in his eyes. He made no move toward Egwene and Elaine, only stood looking at them until one of the accepted appeared at his shoulder.
You should not be in here, she said to him, not unkindly.
I wanted to walk.
His voice was deep and as sad as his eyes. You can walk out in the garden, where you are supposed to be. The sunshine will be good for you. The man rumbled a bitter laugh.
With two or three of you watching my every move, you're just afraid I'll find a knife.
At the look in the accepted's eyes, he laughed again.
For myself, woman. For myself. Lead me to your garden and your watching eyes.
The accepted touched his arm lightly and led him away.
No gain, Elaine said when he was gone. The false dragon.
He has been gentle, Digwayne. He is no more dangerous than any other man now. But I remember seeing him before when it took six Aes Sedai to keep him from wielding the power and destroying us all. She shivered.
Egwene did too. That was what the Red Aja would do to Rand.
Do they always have to be gentled? She asked.
Elaine stared at her, mouth agape, and she quickly added,
It is just that I'd think the Aes Sedai would find some other way to deal with them. Anaya and Moiraine both said the greatest feats of the Age of Legends required men and women working together with the power. I just thought they'd try to find a way.
Well, do not let any Red Sister hear you thinking it aloud. Egwene, they did try. For 300 years after the White Tower was built, they tried. They gave up because there was nothing to find. Come on, I want you to meet Min. Not in the garden where Loghain is going, thank the light.
The name sounded vaguely familiar to Egwene, and when she saw the young woman, she knew why. There was a narrow stream in the garden with a low stone bridge over it, and Min sat cross-legged on the wall of the bridge. She wore a man's tight breeches and baggy shirt, and with her dark hair cut short, she could almost pass for a boy, though an uncommonly pretty one. A gray coat lay beside her on the coping.
I know you, Egwene said. You worked at the inn in Bearlawn.
A light breeze riffled the water beneath the bridge, and gray wings warbled in the trees of the garden. Min smiled.
And you were one of those who brought the Dark Friends down on us to burn it down. No, don't worry. The messenger who came to fetch me brought enough gold that Master Fitch is building it back again twice as big. Good morning, Elaine. Not slaving over your lessons? Or over some pots?
It was said in a bantering tone as between friends, as Elaine's answering grin proved.
I see Shiriam has not yet managed to get you into a dress.
Min's laugh was wicked. I'm no novice. She made her voice squeaky.
Yes, Aes Sedai. No, Aes Sedai. May I sweep another floor, Aes Sedai?
I, she said, resuming her own low voice, clothe myself the way I want. She turned to Egwene. Is Rand well? Egwene's mouth tightened.
He should wear ram's horns like a trollop, she thought angrily.
I was sorry when your inn caught fire, and I'm glad Master Fitch was able to rebuild. Why have you come to Tar Valon? It's clear you do not mean to be an Aes Sedai.
Min arched an eyebrow in what Egwene was sure was amusement.
She likes him, Elaine explained.
I know.
Min glanced at Egwene, and for an instant, Egwene thought she saw sadness, or regret, in her eyes.
I am here, Min said carefully, because I was sent for, and was given the choice between riding and coming tied in a sack.
You always exaggerate it, Elaine said.
Shiriam Sedai saw the letter, and she says it was a request.
Min sees things, Egwene. That's why she's here, so the Aes Sedai can study how she does it. It isn't the power.
Request, Min snorted. When an Aes Sedai requests your presence, it's like a command from a queen with 100 soldiers to back it up.
Everybody sees things, Egwene said.
Elaine shook her head.
Not like Min. She sees auras around people and images.
Not all the time, Min put in. Not around everybody.
And she can read things about you from them, though I'm not sure she always tells the truth. She said I'd have to share my husband with 2 other women, and I'd never put up with that. She just laughs and says it was never her idea of how to run things either. But she said I would be a queen before she knew who I was. She said she saw a crown, and it was the rose crown of Andor.
Despite herself, Egwene asked, "What do you see when you look at me?" Min glanced at her. "A white flame and, oh, all sorts of things. I don't know what it means."
"She says that a great deal," Elaine said dryly. "One of the things she said she saw looking at me was a severed hand. Not mine, she says. She claims she does not know what it means either."
"Because I don't," Min said. "I don't know what half of it means."
The crunch of boots on the walk brought them around to look at two young men with their shirts and coats across their arms, leaving sweaty chests bare and scabbarded swords in their hands. Egwene found herself staring at the most handsome man she had ever seen. Tall and slim, but hard, he moved with a cat-like grace. She suddenly realized he was bowing over her hand. She'd not even felt him take it in his, and fumbled in her mind for the name she had heard.
"Galad,"
she murmured. His dark eyes stared back into hers. He was older than she, older than Rand. At the thought of Rand, she gave a start and came to herself.
"And I am Gawain," the other young man grinned, "since I don't think you heard the first time."
Min was grinning too, and only Elaine wore a frown. Egwene abruptly remembered her hand, still held by Galad, and freed it.
"If your duties allow," Galad said, "I would like to see you again, Egwene. We could walk, or if you obtain permission to leave the tower, we could picnic outside the city."
That would be nice.
She was uncomfortably aware of the others, Min and Gawain still with their amused grins, Elaine still with her scowl. She tried to settle herself to think of Rand.
"He's so beautiful."
She gave a jump, half afraid she'd spoken aloud.
"Until then."
Finally taking his eyes from hers, Galad bowed to Elaine.
"Sister."
Lithe as a blade, he strolled on across the bridge.
"That one," Min murmured, peering after him, "will always do what is right, no matter who it hurts."
"Sister," Egwene said.
Elaine's scowl had lessened only slightly.
"I thought it was your... I mean, the way you're frowning..."
She'd thought Elaine was jealous, and she still was not sure.
"I am not his sister," Elaine said firmly. "I refuse to be."
"Our father was his father," Gawain said dryly. "You cannot deny that unless you want to call mother a liar, and that, I think, would take more nerve than we have between us."
For the first time, Egwene realized that he had the same reddish-gold hair as Elaine, though darkened and curled by sweat.
"Min is right," Elaine said. "Galad has not the smallest part of humanity in him. He takes right above mercy or pity, or he is no more human than a trolloc."
Gawain's grin came back. "I do not know about that. Not from the way he was looking at Egwene here."
He caught her look and his sister's, and held up his hands as if to fend them off with his sheathed sword.
"Besides, he has the best hand with a sword I've ever seen. The warders only need show him something once, and he's learned it. They sweat me nearly to death to learn half what Galad does without trying."
"And being good with a sword is enough?"
Elaine sniffed.
"Men!"
"Egwene, as you may have guessed, this disgracefully unclothed lummox is my brother, Gawain. Egwene knows Rand Althor. She's from the same village."
"Is she? Was he really born in the Two Rivers, Egwene?"
Egwene made herself nod calmly.
"What does he know?" "Of course he was. I grew up with him."
"Of course," Gawain said slowly. "Such a strange fellow. A shepherd, he said, though he never looked or acted like any shepherd I ever saw."
"Strange. I have met all sorts of people, and they've met Rand Althor. Some do not even know his name, but the description could not be anyone else, and he's shifted every one of their lives. There was an old farmer who came to Camelin just to see Loghain, when Loghain was brought through on his way here. Yet the farmer stayed to stand for Mother when the riots started, because of a young man off to see the world who made him think there was more to life than his farm, Rand Althor. You could almost think he was Ta'veren.
Elida is certainly interested in him. I wonder if meeting him will shift our lives in the pattern.
Egwene looked at Elaine and Min. She was sure they could not have a clue that Rand really was Ta'veren. She had never really thought about that part of it before. He was Rand, and he had been cursed with the ability to channel. But Ta'veren did move people, whether they wanted to be moved or not.
I really do like you, she said abruptly, including both girls in her gesture. I want to be your friend.
And I want to be yours, Elaine said. Impulsively, Egwene hugged her, and then Min jumped down and the three of them stood there on the bridge hugging one another all together.
We three are tied together, Min said, and we cannot let any man get in the way of that, not even him.
Would one of you mind telling me what this is all about? Gawain inquired gently.
You would not understand,
his sister said, and the three girls all caught a fit of the giggles. Gawain scratched his head, then shook it.
Well, if it has anything to do with Randall Thor, be sure you don't let Elida hear of it. She has been at me like a white cloak questioner 3 times since we arrived. I do not think she means him any.
He gave a start. There was a woman crossing the garden, a woman in a red-fringed shawl.
Name the Dark One, he quoted, and he appears.
I do not need another lecture about wearing my shirt when I'm out of the practice yards. Good morning to you all. Elida spared a glance for the departing Gawain as she came up the bridge. She was a handsome woman rather than beautiful, Egwene thought, but that ageless look marked her as surely as her shawl. Only the newest maid sisters lacked it. When her gaze swept over Egwene, pausing only a moment, Egwene suddenly saw hardness in the Aes Sedai. She'd always thought of Moiraine as strong, steel under silk, but Elida dispensed with the silk.
Elida, Elaine said, this is Egwene. She was born with the seed in her too, and she has already had some lessons, so she is as far along as I am.
Elida? The Aes Sedai's face was blank and unreadable.
In Camelin, child, I am counselor to the queen, your mother. But this is the White Tower, and you a novice.
Min made as if to go, but Elida stopped her with a sharp, Stay, girl, I would speak with you.
I've known you all my life, Elida, Elaine said incredulously. You watched me grow up, and made the gardens bloom in winter so I could play.
Child, there you were the daughter heir. Here you are a novice. You must learn that. You will be great one day, but you must learn.
Yes, Aes Sedai.
Egwene was astounded. If someone had snubbed her so before others, she would have been in a fury. Now, off with both of you.
A gong began to toll, deep and sonorous, and Elida tilted her head. The sun stood halfway to its pinnacle.
Hi, Elida said. You must hurry if you do not want further admonishment. And Elaine? See the mistress of novices in her study after your chores. A novice does not speak to Aes Sedai unless bidden to. Run, both of you. You will be late. Run.
They ran, holding their skirts up.
Egwene looked at Elaine. Elaine had 2 spots of color in her cheeks and a determined look on her face.
I will be Aes Sedai,
Elaine said softly, but it sounded like a promise. Behind them, Egwene heard the Aes Sedai begin. I'm given to understand, girl, that you were brought here by Moiraine Sedai.
She wanted to stay and listen, to hear if Elida asked about Rand, but High rang through the White Tower, and she was summoned to chores. She ran as she had been commanded to run.
I will be Aes Sedai, she growled. Elaine flashed a quick smile of understanding, and they ran faster. Min's shirt clung to her when she finally left the bridge, not sweat from the sun, but from the heat of Elida's questions. She looked over her shoulder to make sure the Aes Sedai was not following her, but Elida was nowhere in sight. How did Elida know that Moiraine had summoned her? Min had been sure that was a secret known only to her, Moiraine, and Shiriam, and all those questions about Rand. It had not been easy keeping a smooth face and a steady eye while telling an Aes Sedai to her face that she had never heard of him and knew nothing of him. What does she want with him? Light, what does Moiraine want with him? What is he? Light, I don't want to fall in love with a man I've only met once, and a farm boy at that.
Moiraine, the light blind you, she muttered. Whatever you brought me here for, come out from wherever you're hiding and tell me so I can go. The only answer was the sweet song of the Grey Wings. With a grimace, she went in search of a place to cool off.
Chapter 25. Kyrian. The city of Kyrian lay across hills against the river Alguenia, and Rand's first sight of it came from the hills to the north by the light of the midday sun. Elricane Tavalin and the 50 Kyrianan soldiers still seemed like guards to him, the more since crossing the bridge at the Galen. They became more stiff the further south they rode. But Loyal and Huron did not appear to mind, so he tried not to. He studied the city, as large as any he had seen. Fat ships and broad barges filled the river, and tall granaries sprawled along the far bank. But Kyrian seemed to be laid out in a precise grid behind its high gray walls. Those walls themselves made a perfect square, with one side hard along the river. In just as exact a pattern, towers rose within the walls, soaring as much as 20 times the height of the wall, yet even from the hills Rand could see that each one ended in a jagged top. Outside the city walls, surrounding them from riverbank to riverbank, lay a warren of streets crisscrossing at all angles and teeming with people. Forgate, Rand knew it was called, from Huron. Once there had been a market village for every city gate, but over the years they had all grown into one, a hodgepodge of streets and alleys growing up every which way. As Rand and the others rode into those dirt streets, Tavalin put some of his soldiers to clearing a path through the throng, shouting and urging their horses forward as if to trample any who did not get out of the way quickly. People moved aside with no more than a glance, as if it were an everyday occurrence. Rand found himself smiling, though. The Foregate's people's clothes were shabby more often than not, yet much of it was colorful, and there was a raucous bustle of life to the place. Hawkers cried their wares, and shopkeepers called for people to examine the goods displayed on tables before their shops. Barbers, fruit peddlers, knife sharpeners, men and women offering 12 services and 100 things for sale, wandered through the crowds. Music drifted through the babble from more than one structure. At first Rand thought they were inns. But the signs out front all showed men playing flutes or harps, tumbling or juggling, and large as they were, they had no windows. Most of the buildings in Foregate seemed to be wood, however big they were, and a good many looked new, if poorly made. Rand gaped at several that stood 7 stories or more. They swayed slightly, though the people hurrying in and out did not seem to notice. "Peasants," Tavalin muttered, staring straight ahead in disgust. "Look at them, corrupted by outland ways. They should not be here." "Where should they be?" Rand asked. The Kyrianan officer glared at him and spurred his horse forward, flogging at the crowd with his quirt. Huron touched Rand's arm.
"It was the Aiel War, Lord Rand."
He looked to make sure none of the soldiers were close enough to hear.
"Many of the farmers were afraid to go back to their lands near the spine of the world, and they all came here near enough. That's why Galdrian has the river full of grain barges up from Andor and Tyr. There's no crops coming from farms in the east because there aren't any farms anymore. Best not to mention it to a Kyrianan, though, my lord. They like to pretend the war never happened, or at least that they won it."
Despite Tavalin's quirt, they were forced to halt while a strange procession crossed their path. 6 men, beating tambours and dancing, led the way for a string of huge puppets, each half again as tall as the men who worked them with long poles. Giant crowned figures of men and women in long ornate robes bowed to the crowd amid the shapes of fanciful beasts, a lion with wings, a goat walking on its hind legs with 2 heads, both of which were apparently meant to be breathing fire from the crimson streamers hanging from the 2 mouths. Something that seemed to be half cat and half eagle, and another with a bear's head on a man's body, which Rand took to be a trolloc. The crowd cheered and laughed as they pranced by.
"Man who made that never saw a trolloc," Huron grumbled. "Head's too big, and it's too skinny. Likely didn't believe in them either, my lord, any more than in those other things. The only monsters these Foregate folk believe in are Aiel."
"Are they having a festival?" Rand asked.
He did not see any sign of it other than the procession, but he thought that there must be a reason for that. Tavalin ordered his soldiers forward again.
"No more than every day, Rand," Loyal said.
Walking alongside his horse, the blanket-wrapped chest still wrapped to his saddle, the Ogier drew as many looks as the puppets had. Some even laughed and clapped as they had for the puppets.
"I fear Galdrian keeps his people quiet by entertaining them. He gives gleemen and musicians the king's gift, a bounty in silver to perform here in the foregate, and he sponsors horse races down by the river every day. There are fireworks many nights, too."
He sounded disgusted.
"Elder Hammond says Galdrian is a disgrace."
He blinked, realizing what he had said, and looked around hurriedly to see if any of the soldiers had heard. None seemed to have. "Fireworks," Hiren said, nodding. "The Illuminators have built a chapter house here, I've heard. The same as in Tanchico. I didn't half mind seeing the fireworks when I was here before."
Rand shook his head. He had never seen fireworks elaborate enough to require even one illuminator. He had heard they only left Tanchico to put on displays for rulers. It was a strange place he was coming to. At the tall square archway of the city gate, Tavalin ordered a halt and dismounted by a squat stone building just inside the walls. It had arrow slits instead of windows and a heavy iron-bound door.
"A moment, my Lord Rand," the officer said. Tossing his reins to one of the soldiers, he disappeared inside. With a wary look at the soldiers, they sat their horses rigidly in two long files. Rand wondered what they would do if he and Loyal and Hiren tried to leave. He took the opportunity to study the city that lay before him. Kyrian proper was a sharp contrast to the chaotic bustle of the foregate. Broad paved streets, wide enough to make the people in them seem fewer than they were, crossed each other at right angles. Just as in Tremoncienne, the hills had been carved and terraced to straight lines. Closed sedan chairs, some with small pennants bearing the sigil of a house, moved with deliberateness, and carriages rolled down the streets slowly. People went silently in dark clothes, with no bright colors except here and there slashes across the breast of coat or dress. The more slashes, the more proudly the wearer moved, but no one laughed or even smiled. The buildings on their terraces were all of stone, and the ornamentation was straight-lined and sharp-angled. There were no hawkers or peddlers in the streets, and even the shops seemed subdued, with only small signs and no wares displayed outside. He could see the great towers more clearly now. Scaffolds of lashed poles surrounded them, and workmen swarmed on scaffolding, laying new stones to push the towers higher still.
"The topless towers of Kyrian," Loyal murmured sadly. "Well, they were tall enough to warrant the name once. When the Aiel took Kyrian, about the time you were born, the towers burned and cracked and fell. I don't see any Ogier among the stonemasons. No Ogier could like working here. The Kyrianin want what they want without embellishment. But there were Ogier when I was here before."
Tavalin came out, trailing another officer and two clerks, one carrying a large wood-bound ledger and the other a tray with writing implements. The front of the officer's head was shaven like Tavalin's, though advancing baldness seemed to have taken more hair than the razor. Both officers looked from Rand to the chest hidden by Loyal's striped blanket and back again. Neither asked what was under the blanket. Tavalin had looked at it often on the way from Tremoncienne, but he had never asked either. The balding man looked at Rand's sword, too, and pursed his lips for an instant. Tavalin gave the other officer's name as Asan Sander, and announced loudly, "Lord Rand of House Althor in Andor, and his man called Hurin, with Loyal and Ogier of Steading Shangtai." The clerk with the ledger opened it across his two arms, and Sander wrote the names in a round hand. "You must return to this guardhouse by this same hour tomorrow, my lord," Sander said, leaving the sanding to the second clerk. "And give the name of the inn where you are staying." Rand looked at the staid streets of Kyrian, then back at the liveliness of the foregate. "Can you tell me the name of a good inn out there?" He nodded to the foregate. Hiren made a frantic "st" and leaned close.
"It would not be proper, Lord Rand," he whispered.
if you stay in the foregate, being lord and all, they'll be sure you are up to something.
Rand could see the sniffer was right. Sunder's mouth had dropped open, and Tavalin's brows had risen at his question, and they were both still watching him intently. He wanted to tell them he was not playing their great game, but instead he said,
"We will take rooms in the city. We can go now."
"Of course, my lord Rand,"
Sunder made a bow.
"But the inn?"
"I will let you know when we find one." Rand turned red, then paused. Celine's note crackled in his pocket. "I need to find a young woman from Kyrian, the Lady Celine. She is my age and beautiful. I don't know her house." Sandair and Tavalin exchanged looks, then Sandair said,
"I will make inquiries, my lord. Perhaps I will be able to tell you something when you come tomorrow."
Rand nodded and led Loyal and Huron into the city. They attracted little notice, though there were few riders. Even Loyal attracted almost none. The people seemed nearly ostentatious about minding their own business.
"Will they take it the wrong way?" Rand asked Huron. "My asking after Celine?" "Who can say with Carrionan, Lord Rand? They seem to think everything has to do with Deus de Mar."
Rand shrugged. He felt as if people were looking at him. He could not wait to get a good, plain coat again and stop pretending to be what he was not. Huron knew several inns in the city, though his time in Kyrian had been spent mainly in the foregate. The sniffer led them to one called the Defender of the Dragon Wall, the sign bearing a crowned man with his foot on another man's chest and his sword at the man's throat. The fellow on his back had red hair. A hostler came to take their horses, darting quick looks at Rand and at Loyal when he thought he was not observed. Rand told himself to stop having fancies. Not everyone in the city could be playing this game of theirs. And if they were, he was no part of it. The common room was neat, with the tables laid out as strictly as the city, and only a few people at them. They glanced up at the newcomers, then back to their wine immediately. Rand had the feeling they were still watching, though, and listening. A small fire burned in the big fireplace, though the day was warming. The innkeeper was a plump, unctuous man with a single stripe of green across his dark gray coat. He gave a start at his first sight of them, and Rand was not surprised. Loyal, with the chest in his arms, under its striped blanket, had to duck his head to make it in through the door. Huron was burdened with all their saddlebags and bundles, and his own red coat was a sharp contrast to the somber colors the people at the tables wore. The innkeeper took in Rand's coat and his sword, and his oily smile came back. He bowed, washing his smooth hands.
"Forgive me, my lord. It was just that for a moment I took you for... Forgive me. My brain is not what it was. You wish rooms, my lord?"
He added another, lesser bow for Loyal.
"I am called Quail, my lord."
He thought I was Aiel, Rand thought sourly. He wanted to be gone from Kyrian, but it was the one place Ingtar might find them, and Celine had said she would wait for him in Kyrian. It took a little time for their rooms to be readied, Quail explaining with too many smiles and bows that it was necessary to move a bed for Loyal. Rand wanted them all to share a room again, but between the innkeeper's scandalized looks and Huron's insistence,
"We have to show these Carrion and we know what's right as well as they do, Lord Rand,"
they ended with two, one for him alone, with a connecting door. The rooms were much the same, except that theirs had two beds, one sized for an ogier, while his had only one bed, and that almost as big as the other two, with massive square posts that nearly reached the ceiling. His tall-backed padded chair and the washstand were square and massive, too, and the wardrobe standing against his wall was carved in a heavy, rigid style that made the thing look ready enough to fall over on him. A pair of windows siding his bed looked out on the street two floors below. As soon as the innkeeper left, Rand opened the door and admitted Loyal and Huron into his room.
"This place gnaws at me," he told them. "Everybody looks at you as if they think you're doing something. I'm going back to the foregate, for an hour anyway. At least the people laughed there. Which of you is willing to take the first watch on the horn?"
"I will stay," Loyal said quickly. "I'd like a chance to do a little reading.
Just because I didn't see any Ogier does not mean there are no stonemasons down from Steading Tsofu. It is not far from the city.
I'd think you would want to meet them.
No, Rand.
They asked enough questions the last time about why I was outside alone as it was. If they've had word from Steading Shangtai, well, I will just rest here and read, I think.
Rand shook his head. He often forgot that Loyal had run away from home, in effect, to see the world. What about you, Huron? There's music in the foregate, and people laughing. I'll wager no one is playing Deus de Mar there.
I would not be so certain of that myself, Lord Rand. In any case, I thank you for the invitation, but I think not. There's so many fights, and killings too, in the foregate, that it stinks, if you know what I mean. Not that they're likely to bother a lord, of course. The soldiers would be down on them if they did. But if it pleases you, I would like to have a drink in the common room.
Huron, you don't need my permission for anything, you know that.
As you say, my lord.
The sniffer gave a suggestion of a bow. Rand took a deep breath. If they did not leave Kyrian soon, Huron would be bowing and scraping left and right. And if Matt and Perrin saw that, they would never let him forget it.
I hope nothing delays Ingtar. If he doesn't come quickly, we'll have to take the horn back to Faldara ourselves.
He touched Celine's note through his coat.
We will have to.
Loyal, I'll come back so you can see some of the city.
I'd rather not risk it,
Loyal said. Huron accompanied Rand downstairs. As soon as they reached the common room, Kuel was bowing in front of Rand, pushing a tray at him. Three folded and sealed parchments lay on the tray. Rand took them, since that was what the innkeeper seemed to intend. They were a fine grade of parchment, soft and smooth to his touch. Expensive. What are these? He asked. Quail bowed again.
Invitations, of course, my lord, from three of the noble houses.
He bowed himself away. Who would send me invitations? Rand turned them over in his hand. None of the men at the tables looked up, but he had the feeling they were watching just the same. He did not recognize the seals. None was the crescent, moon, and stars Celine had used. Who would know I was here?
Everyone by now, Lord Rand, Huron said quietly.
He seemed to feel eyes watching, too.
The guards at the gate would not keep their mouths closed about an outland lord coming to Kyrian. The hostler, the innkeeper, everybody tells what they know where they think it will do them the most good, my lord.
With a grimace, Rand took two steps and hurled the invitations into the fire. They caught immediately.
I am not playing Deus de Mar, he said, loudly enough for everyone to hear. Not even Coel looked at him. I have nothing to do with your great game. I am just here to wait for some friends.
Huron caught his arm.
Please, Lord Rand.
His voice was an urgent whisper.
Please, don't do that again.
Again? You really think I'll receive more?
I'm certain. Light, but you remind me of the time Teeva got so mad at a hornet buzzing round his ears, he kicked the nest. You've likely just convinced everyone in the room you're in some deep part of the game. It must be deep, as they'll see it, if you deny playing at all. Every lord and lady in Kyrian plays it.
The sniffer glanced at the invitations, curling blackly in the fire, and winced.
And you have surely made enemies of three houses. Not great houses, or they'd not have moved so quickly, but still noble. You must answer any more invitations you receive, my lord. Decline if you will, though they'll read things into whose invitations you do decline, and into whose you accept. Of course, if you decline them all, or accept them all, I'll have no part of it, Rand said quietly. We are leaving Kyrian as soon as we can.
He thrust his fists into his coat pockets and felt Celine's note crumple. Pulling it out, he smoothed it on his coat front.
As soon as we can, he muttered, putting it back in his pocket again. Have your drink, Huron.
He stalked out angrily, not sure whether he was angry with himself or with Kyrian and its great game, or Celine for vanishing, or Moraine. She had started it all, stealing his coats and giving him a lord's clothes instead. Even now that he called himself free of them, and I said I still managed to interfere in his life, and without even being there. He went back through the same gate by which he had entered the city, since that was the way he knew. A man standing in front of the guardhouse took note of him. His bright coat marked him out, as well as his height among the Kyrianen, and hurried inside, but Rand did not notice. The laughter and music of the foregate were pulling him on. If his gold-embroidered red coat made him stand out inside the walls, it fit right into the foregate. Many of the men milling through the crowded streets were dressed just as darkly as those in the city, but just as many wore coats of red or blue or green or gold, some bright enough to be a tinker's clothes. And even more of the women had embroidered dresses and colored scarves or shawls. Most of the finery was tattered and ill-fitting, as if made for someone else originally, but if some of those who wore it eyed his fine coat, none seemed to take it amiss. Once he had to stop for another procession of giant puppets. While the drummers beat their tambours and capered, a pig-faced trollic with tusks fought a man in a crown. After a few desultory blows, the trollic collapsed to laughter and cheers from the onlookers. Rand grunted. They don't die so easily as that. He glanced into one of the large windowless buildings, stopping to look through the door. To his surprise, it seemed to be one huge room open to the sky in the middle and lined with balconies, with a large dais at one end. He had never seen or heard of anything like it. People jammed the balconies in the floor, watching people perform on the dais. He peeked into others as he passed them and saw jugglers and musicians, any number of tumblers, and even a gleeman with his cloak of patches, declaiming a story from the Great Hunt of the Horn in sonorous voice high chant. That made him think of Tom Marilyn, and he hurried on. Memories of Tom were always sad. Tom had been a friend who had died for him, while I ran away and let him die. In another of the big structures, a woman in voluminous white robes appeared to make things vanish from one basket and appear in another, then disappear from her hands in great puffs of smoke. The crowd watching her oohed and awed loudly.
"Two coppers, my good lord," a ratty little man in the doorway said. "Two coppers to see the Aes Sedai."
"I don't think so." Rand glanced back at the woman. A white dove had appeared in her hands. "Aes Sedai?" "No." He gave the ratty man a small bow and left. He was making his way through the throng, wondering what to see next, when a deep voice, accompanied by the plucking of a harp, drifted out from a doorway with the sign of a juggler over it.
"Cold blows the wind down Shara Pass. Cold lies the grave unmarked. Yet every year at Sunday, upon those piled stones appears a single rose, one crystal teardrop, like dew upon the petals, laid by the fair hand of Dunsinin. For she keeps fast to the bargain made by Rogosh Eagle-Eye."
The voice drew Rand like a rope. He pushed through the doorway as applause rose within.
"Two coppers, my good lord," said a rat-faced man, who could have been twin to the other. "Two coppers to see."
Rand dug out some coins and thrust them at the man. He walked on in a daze, staring at the man bowing on the dais to the clapping of his listeners, cradling his harp in one arm, and with the other spreading his patch-covered cloak as if to trap all the sound they made. He was a tall man, lanky and not young, with long mustaches as white as the hair on his head, and when he straightened and saw Rand, the eyes that widened were sharp and blue.
"Tom."
Rand's whisper was lost in the noise of the crowd. Holding Rand's eye, Tom Marilyn nodded slightly toward a small door beside the dais. Then he was bowing again, smiling and basking in the applause. Rand made his way to the door and through it. It was only a small hallway with three steps leading up to the dais. In the other direction from the dais, Rand could see a juggler practicing with colored balls and six tumblers limbering themselves. Tom appeared on the steps, limping as though his right leg did not bend as well as it had. He eyed the juggler and the tumblers, blew out his mustaches disdainfully, and turned to Rand.
"All they want to hear is the Great Hunt of the Horn. You would think with the news from Haddenmerk and Saldaea, one of them would ask for the Koreathon cycle. Well, maybe not that, but I'd pay myself to tell something else."
He looked Rand up and down. You look as if you're doing well, boy. He fingered Rand's collar and pursed his lips.
Very well.
Rand could not help laughing. I left Whitebridge sure you were dead. Moraine said you were still alive, but I...
Like Tom, it's good to see you again. I should have gone back to help you.
Bigger fool if you had, boy. That fade...
He looked around. There was no one close enough to hear, but he lowered his voice anyway.
Had no interest in me. It left a little present of a stiff leg and ran off after you and Matt. All you could have done was die.
He paused, looking thoughtful.
Moraine said I was still alive, did she? Is she with you, then?
Rand shook his head. To his surprise, Tom seemed disappointed.
Too bad, in a way. She's a fine woman, even if she is.
He left it unsaid.
So it was Matt or Perrin she was after. I won't ask which. They were good boys, and I don't want to know.
Rand shifted uneasily and gave a start when Tom fixed him with a bony finger.
What I do want to know is, do you still have my harp and flute? I want them back, boy. What I have now are not fit for a pig to play.
I have them, Tom. I'll bring them to you, I promise. I can't believe you are alive. And I can't believe you want an Ilion. The great hunt setting out. The prize for the best telling of the great hunt of the horn. You were dying to go.
Tom snorted.
After Whitebridge? Likely I'd die if I did go. Even if I could have reached the boat before it sailed, Doman and his whole crew would be spreading the tale all over Ilion about how I was being chased by Trollocs. If they saw the fade, or heard of it, before Doman cut his lines... Most Ilianas think Trollocs and fades are fables, but enough others might want to know why a man was pursued by them to make Ilion somewhat more the uncomfortable.
Tom, I have so much to tell you.
The Gleeman cut him off.
Later, boy.
He was exchanging glares down the length of the hall with the narrow-faced man from the door.
If I don't go back and tell another, he will no doubt send the juggler out, and that lot will tear the hall down around our heads. You come to the bunch of grapes just beyond the Jangai Gate. I have a room there. Anyone can tell you where to find it. I'll be there in another hour or so. One more tale will have to satisfy them.
He started back up the steps, flinging over his shoulder.
And bring my harp and my flute.